is in Silk. Silk, pleased to meet you. Now how do I do this? I press record. Okay. The title is here. There are handouts here. I'm going to read all of the sources. If you'd like to see them inside, just feel free to grab these handouts. A lot of them are in Hebrew. I'm going to translate all of them, but I'm going to certainly read them out loud.
Okay.
So this way, I put the packets over there. Okay, good.
Which one is it?
We're doing Psalm 42 and 43. Now, I guess the first thing I really have to talk about, there's the small packet, there's the single sheet, and then there's the large packet. If you have the single sheet, you know, I'm going to grab one also, a single sheet, just so I can have the same translation. No, you take, oh, I'll just take the translation. This way I'm translating the same as yours.
Yeah, this is bigger.
Now,
which one are you doing
now? We're doing Psalm 42 and 43. Tila Mem Bet and Tila Mem Gimel. Now, I guess the first thing I really have to start off with is explain why we're doing Tila Mem Bet and Mem Gimel. And in fact, Tila Mem Bet and Mem Gimel, 42 and 43, are actually one song. They're one song. If you take a look just on your page, so you have 42 that runs down to the bottom of the page, and then if you turn over, you'll see it looks like it ends, and then 43 starts with Avenge Me, O God, or Shofteni Elohim, ends three quarters down the page. So I guess before starting to teach Psalm 42, 43, I should explain something about the fact, about why I'm saying that it's one tehillah, with one psalm, when in fact you have two in front of you. So the answer is, I don't know why it's two. But first of all, I'd like to show you why in fact it's one. The first thing that you can identify, and towards the end of the lesson, I'll try to show you why it may have been broken apart into two different psalms. But first, I'd like to establish the fact that the psalm is in fact one. So, if you take a look at verse 6 on page 50, why are you downcast, my soul, and why do you stir within me? Hope to God, for I will yet thank Him for the salvation of His presence. If you don't mind, I prefer actually to do the Hebrew, it's more beautiful. And we're going to discuss this verse quite a bit in detail. But I'd like to show you also, at the very bottom of the page, where it says verse 12, and then you'll have to turn the page. Essentially the same verse. And now if you take a look at the end of 43, verse 5 of Psalm 43, so when you look at the refrains, and there are, I'm going to talk a little bit about what refrains do, it's sort of like a chorus in a modern rock song. There's a reason why there are certain songs with refrains, and there's a certain effect that they have, so we'll discuss a little bit later on when we understand the tehillah better. We'll get back to the issue of the refrains. I want to just point out why, at least establish the fact that even though you have Perek Mem Bet and Perek Mem Gimel, you have chapter 42 and 43, the fact that it's one psalm shouldn't disturb you. If you have the packets on the first page, I'm going to read you from the Gemara Brachot, the first chapter on the 10th page. It says, Shma mina ashrei ha'ish v'lama ragshu agoyim chada parshehi. Psalm 1 and Psalm 2 are the same psalm. That's what the Gemara says. Which means, what's fascinating here is that the divisions of the Psalms is very old. It predates the Gemara itself. And the Gemara doesn't necessarily like the divisions. The Gemara is saying that essentially Psalm 1 and Psalm 2, do you have this packet? If not, I'm going to read everything. The Gemara goes on to say, "Amar Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani, Rabbi Shmuel the son of Nachmani says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, the name of Yochanan, Kol Parsha Shahayta Chaviva La Al David, every one of the Tehillim which David loved, Patach Ba Ba'Ashrei, V'Siyim Ba Ba'Ashrei. He opened it up with Ashrei, and he ended it off the last verse. He sealed it up with Ashrei. How do I know that? Patach Ba'Ashrei Dichtiv in the first Tehillah Ashrei Ha'ish, Ashrei Ish Shelo Halach Basar Hashem, etc., etc. The Siyim Ba'Ashrei, he sealed it with Ashrei Dichtiv at the end of the second Tehillah Ashrei Kol Chosei Vav." Which is, again, this kind of a further proof. Here it says Tehillim Aleph and Tehillim Bet, but the rabbis of the Gemara point out that there is no such thing as Tehillim Aleph and Bet. They really belong to, at least according to this opinion, they belong to a single psalm. So you just be aware of the idea that just because we have chapter 1 and chapter 2, it could be the same psalm. So too in 42 and 43. I'm going to show a few more reasons why we should suspect that they are the same. By the way, it's an interesting question that Tosfos brings down that we're not really going to get into, which is, it says here that every time David really wanted to show it to Hila was beautiful, he opened up with Ashrei and ended with Ashrei, which is nice, but that's the only one. there are no others with Ashrei that with Ashrei. The answer is interesting, Tosfos answer. There are other possible answers, so I won't get into it, but just it's something to think about. As you're reading Gemara, it's not always as simple as meets the eye, so that's a separate issue altogether. Yeah, please. That's what the Gemara is saying. And based on that combination, it shows that it's one long, one and two, Psalm 1 and 2 are really one long psalm, which starts with Ashrei, the beginning of one, and it ends with Ashrei at the beginning of the... Yeah, the word Ashrei appears at the beginning of the end of the psalm.
Okay, Ashrei stops the...
Oh, you're talking about the one we do in Davening.
No, that's one question. Ashrei stops the Ashrei.
You're talking about in the Ashrei that we say, the Tehillah David that we say during morning
yeah.
prayers. So they actually, those three Ashreis are taken from three different psalms, and they're in the middle of those psalms, and they're simply placed as a header for the prayer that we say in the morning Psukei Dezimra. One of those psalms we're going to do a little bit of today, but they don't start the psalm that they belong to. Happens to be that when the rabbis were putting together this prayer, they distinctly wanted to start that psalm with a few Ashreis, so they plucked out Ashreis from other psalms. So the psalm that we say, which is Tehillah David, it's an acrostic. It starts with Aronim Chava Emelech and ends with Tuf, the letter Tuf. Well, actually, then it goes back to another letter. That has no word Ashrei in it whatsoever. It's just an acrostic. Three Ashreis were plucked out of different psalms and placed at the very beginning of that Psalm 145. But just because they like the word Ashrei, not because it really starts the psalm at all. What's interesting is, I guess we could spend a lot of time on it because it's interesting, but it's a little technical. How did the chaptering systems get, if the rabbi saw this as one psalm, then who made it two psalms? And this happens more than once. It happens with R 42 and 43. It happens in Hallel. We have Lolanu that we say is actually part of the previous psalm. That's the way it's listed in most of the good texts. And unfortunately, it has its own chapter, so you don't even know that you're splitting a psalm up in two, which is the point there. That's how you're breaking up the hollow, by saying half of the psalm and then you don't say Lovanu. You're literally skipping half of the chapter, even though it's listed as a separate chapter. Most chapterings that we have, like if you open up to Genesis 10, that's Christian. If I tell you open up to Exodus 23, verse 14, that's Christian. That was created by a guy named Stephen Langton, who was a good Bible scholar during the, I want to say, 1200s, maybe a little bit earlier. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury, and they wanted to force the Jews to be able to respond to them in dispute, so they gave it a chaptering system. It's such a good chaptering system that we use it to this day, and we've made an attempt or two to displace it. It's never been successfully displaced. These chapters, however, are much more ancient. These chapters go back, if you open up the Dead Sea Scrolls has Tehillim, the Dead Sea sect, and it was broken down into our chaptering system that you see before you. So the chaptering system is quite ancient, and in fact, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Bible, has 42 and 43 as two separate psalms, and there's no doubt about it, because it actually inserts something in between the two psalms. Eusebius, who was one of the early church fathers, said it's not true, those two psalms are united, and that is our Jewish view as well. Sfardim, by the way, on the second day of Sukkot, say this psalm is one, 42, 43. So it's certainly our tradition that it's one psalm. And let's take a look at the psalm and see if we can see why it is one. And by doing so, we'll also get a good feel. We'll read a few verses and we'll see why it is one psalm. First of all, I'd like to point out some linguistic connections. If you take a look in verse 4 on page 50 and verse 11 on page 50. I don't know if the English will get it. Let's try the English. If it doesn't work, we'll do the Hebrew. My tears were bred day and night when they said to me all day long, where is your God? Now that's part of the first stanza, which ends, if you remember, with verse 6, which was the refrain. Are you okay with the... Do you see where?
Yeah.
Okay. If I'm going too fast, by the way, please stop me, and I'll slow down. And if you wanted to, the truth is, you could probably underline if you really want to get a verse. And if you have a pen, if not, just sort of mentally, you should probably think of verse 6 as the end of the first stanza. Verse 12 is the end of the second stanza, and the last verse in 43 is the end of the third stanza. And that's a way to break up the psalm into A, B, and C. And they really are three stanzas that have three separate sets of images and ideas, broken up by this chorus, essentially, a refrain. So verse 4 says, my tears were with me, were my bread day and night, when they said to me all day long, where is your God? These are the enemies saying to this poor guy, where's your God that you keep talking to and praying to? Would anybody like to make a refrain? Good. Okay. Verse 11 reads, with murder in my bones, my oppressors have reproached me by saying to me all day long, where is your God? So there's that Ayei Elohecha in both places, and that's an idea that connects the first two stanzas. There's more that connects them. If you take a look at verse 5, there's a one-page psalm there with both, if you have your own psalm, so you don't need it, and there's a packet as well if you want it, but it's not absolutely necessary. Verse 5 says, these things I will remember, I will pour out my soul because of the pain which is upon me, how I passed on the throng, etc., etc. If you take now a look at verse 7, my God, my soul is downcast upon me, therefore I will remember you. Now in English it doesn't sound so good, but if you take a look in the Hebrew, if you look at verse 5, it starts with Ela Ezkira, this I will remember. Now if you go to stanza 2, verse 7, it says, Alkein ez korcha, and therefore I will remember you. That's something, another thing that connects verses, stanzas 1 and 2. Another connection between stanzas 1 and 2 is verse 4. My tears were my bread day and night, when they say to me all along, where is your God? Now if you look at verse 9, day and night. Do you see that? By day my Lord commanded his kindness, at night may his resting place with me, a prayer to God all my life. So you have that idea in Hebrew, yomam valayla, is used both in verse 4 as well as verse 9 to connect those two stanzas. And finally, I'd like to connect the last stanza, which has been left alone a little bit. If you take a look at verse 10, which is towards the bottom of page 50, I will say to my God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Why should I walk in gloom under the oppression of my enemy? And now if you turn the page to Psalm 43, which is really just an extension of 42, you'll see verse 2 says, for you are the God of my strength, why have you abandoned me? Why should I walk in gloom under the oppression of my enemy? Let me just read it in Hebrew because you can feel it much stronger. Verse 10 reads, Omra le'el sali, that's the God who is my rock, lama shechachtani, lama kodere lech v'lachatoyev. And now if you go to verse 2, Ki ata Elohei ma'uzi, as opposed to sali, it's ma'uzi, lama zinachtani, as opposed to shechachtani. So it rhymes, it's accidental as well as rhyming. Lama koder et halech b'lachat oyev. It's almost word for word the same idea. So that's something that essentially what we've done is we've shown that the same words are connecting the psalm throughout to give you the impression that, just to really show you that the two psalms are really one quite stitched together. And now I guess we get to the most important part, which is now that we've established that there is a verbal and rhyming and accidental connection between the two sections of the three sections of the psalm and the two separate chapters. Let's talk about the actual idea of the psalm. That is, why is the psalmist, why is the poet here talking? What is his reason for writing the psalm? So if we read it, it becomes actually quite clear. We'll read a little bit of chapter 1 and then chapter 2. And it should become quite evident what the connecting values are. Ka'ayal tarog alafike mayim. like a hart, some kind of deer or other animal of the type, who desires, who stands on the, well, here it says, for the, who desires for the rivulets of water. Afikim really is better. Afikim is more like a white water, like a rapid, actually. So rivulets here is not a great translation. Kein nashi tarog elech Elohim. So right here it's nice. Usually in imagery you have to sort of try to figure out what the imagery is. Here we have a simile. X is like Y. My soul that longs for you, O God, is just like a harp that has no water, that that waits for the waters to come back because it's thirsty. And just in case you missed the thirst imagery, we have in the next verse, Sama nafshi l'Elohim. My soul thirsts for God. L'El Chai, to the God of my life, towards the living God. Matai avo ve'ira'e p'nei Elohim. When will I come to see the face of God? Now here's a little bit strange. I translated it wrong, because ve'ira'e is passive. It's very strange. Matai avo, when will I come, ve'ira'e, and will I be seen, p'nei Elohim. Doesn't sound like you want a passive verb. It sounds like you want to see, not to be seen. And in fact, unfortunately, there are many modern scholars that correct this text and say, ve'ira'e, and I will see the face of God. Unfortunately, modern scholars don't know much Tanakh. They know a lot about Tanakh, but they don't know much Tanakh. So if you take a look at your second page in your handout, if you have it, you'll recognize these verses. There are two from Shemot and one from Devarim. Shalosh pa'amim b'shana, three times in a year, ye'ra'eh kol zchurcha p'nei Adon Hashem. Your seed, your children will be seen in the passive. Shemot perek lamed dalet also. Shalosh pa'amim b'shana, ye'ra'eh kol zchurcha p'nei Adon Hashem elokei Yisrael. And finally, Devarim, shalosh pa'amim b'shana ye'ra'eh kol zchurcha p'nei Hashem elokecha makom ha'shev chavachai ha'matzot. There's no doubt that this is what the psalmist has in mind. That's why he uses the word Yera'eh, and the fact that these scholars don't know how to read Tanakh, it shows. So before you listen to them about correcting text, which looks a little difficult, if you only know our Tehillah, so the pasuk is very strange, you're tempted to change it. I think they knew what they were talking about. Baruch Hashem Tehillim, they know what they're talking about, and they're relying on us to know our Tanakh. So that's essentially what you have here. The word El Chai is also the idea of Mayim Chayim, like a water flowing. And the idea is well established. As soon as you see Ve'ira'et Pnei Elohim, anybody who reads this text, familiar with Tanakh, knows exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about pilgrimage. There's no doubt. And just in case you had any doubt, if we skip Dal and go to Hey, Eila Ezkira Ve'especha Alai Nafshi. These are the things I'll remember as I cry out my soul, as I pour out my soul, which means as I cry. Ki Evor Besach, and that's a difficult word, but it's probably short for Sukkah. As I cross over the Sukkah. Now, Sukkah should remind you, of course, the Beit HaMikdash, just like we say in the Tehillah LeDavid. It's Ki it's Benini B'Sukkoh, the Yom Ra'ai is Fedi B'Seitro Alo. The word Sukkah or Sukkat no Sukkat David HaNofelet, the word Sukkah is very often connected with the Beit HaMikdash. Good evening. Hey. There are Tehillim, there's a one-page Tehillah over there, and there are packets also within my... This person is dreaming. He's dreaming of Zion. He says, these are the things that I remember. I remember when I cross over the Sach, when I cross over towards the temple. Edadim ad Beit Elohim, there's no doubt. Now, Edadim is a very difficult word. I'm not going to try to explain every single word here. If you're curious, we can talk about it later. But it probably means measure or walk by or some such thing. As I walk to the Beit Elohim, the Kol Rinah V'Todah, with the voice of joy and of thanksgiving, Hamon Chogeg, everybody's partying. I doubt that's the translation, but that's the correct, that's probably the word you should be feeling. Hamon Chogeg, everybody is Chag. By the way, not only is there an idea of pilgrimage here. No, it's okay. So make sure everybody's okay. Not only is there the pilgrimage, but the idea of Sukkot specifically. The word Sach, the word Chag, of course, is more connected to Sukkot than that holiday. So it's not, and of course, Mayim, water, should remind you of Sukkot more than any other holiday. The Simchat Beit HaShoeivah, the drawing of the water, that's the time when it starts to rain again in Israel, so everybody's very excited because the rain starts coming down. So the image of the pilgrimage to the temple is in his mind, more specifically pilgrimage during Sukkot, during the water season, but he only remembers. And as he remembers this, he cries. Now, to show you the connection to Psalm 43, if we go to the third stanza of the psalm, if you turn the page, there's a seat here. Please, there's a seat here. Please come. This way I won't feel like the only guy. To be perfectly honest, you make me feel much more comfortable. Because I feel outnumbered, to say the least. That's right. I'm sorry, Yonatan, I think. If Guido was here, you'd notice he'd be running around. And yeah, please.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want me to get you a... Here, I'll get you a...
That's all right.
So if you look at 43, if you just look at the English, you can immediately see the temple imagery returns again. Not only the temple image, it's not really imagery, it's specifically talking about the temple. If you like, you can use one of these handouts. It may come along.
Thank you.
If we start from verse 3, Shlach orchav amitcha hemo yanchuni. Send me your light and your truth. They will give me rest. Yiviuni al har kotzecha v'al mishkan al tacha. You can't miss it. To your holy temple, to your mishkan. Va'avoa, and let me come. El mizbach Elohim. By the way, avoa doesn't mean I will come. It means let me come. Whenever you have an ah at the end, see that ah at the end? That means let me. So you have to be a little careful. Sometimes people have a little, for instance, Hoshia, which ends with an ayin, means save me. Hoshia, with a hey at the end, means let me be saved. One is a command or a prediction, and one is begging. So there's you have to watch it. Whenever you see an ah at the end of a verb, so be careful, it may be a request for something. In this case, avoa means let me come. How does the English do it? And I will come. That's wrong. It means let me come is the correct translation. That's an important idea, although I don't want to get too much into grammar because I'll have everybody sleeping in no time. And I will praise you with my harp, or my, I guess kinor is more of a lute, Elohim Elohai. The imagery is clear. He wants to come back. He wants to come back to Zion. He misses it. He's crying about the memories that he has, about the fact that he remembers what it was like to go to the Beit HaMikdash. He remembers when he heard the voices of people with pleasure going up to the Beit HaMikdash. He remembers the rain. He remembers the beauty. And now he can't have it anymore. And it's tearing him apart. That's really the flow of the psalm. And that's how also you can see the connection between 42 and 43. So with that, I want to take a little bit of a... If you turn the page to if you have a packet, who wrote the psalm? I want to address an issue which is really not to the psalm directly, but it's an important one that needs to be resolved before we go on and study psalms. If you notice, I avoided saying David when I said David. What did David have in mind? I avoided saying it because even though the general sense is that David wrote all of Tehillim, that is probably not correct. There is Jewish tradition that says David wrote all Tehillim. Rav Sajja Gaon of the 800s, 900s, the famous battler against the Karaites, said it. The Ibn Ezra prefers it. And the Ibn Ezra is not willing, you know, Ibn Ezra will go against the customary, the more midrashic or, traditional interpretation when he feels that he has to. Nonetheless, the Gemara itself says that 10 people wrote psalms. If you have the packet, I quoted the Gemara in Bava Batra. The Gemara in Bava Batra goes through the authorship of all the books. And some of them will surprise you, by the way. For instance, Sefer Daniel was not written by Daniel. Sefer Yeshayahu was not written by Yeshayahu. Sefer, there are quite a few surprises. Sefer Mishlei, not written by Shlomo. Some of it was, but not all of it. So, and when you say written, we also have to remember that there's two stages to a writing of any book. There's the writing, which actually can be a long, drawn-out process, and there's also the redaction of the book, the editing of the book into a book. But the Gemara pulls no punches. This is rabbinic view. This is not a non-traditional view. This is the most traditional view. David katav sefer tehillim al yedei asaraz kinim. He wrote it by the hands of ten kinim. The oldest one listed here are the three children of Korach, whom maybe David knew. I'm sorry. Haman, Yedutun, and Asaph, who were three prophets who prophesied, and singers, they were Levim, who prophesied during David's time. Shlomo is brought down, and Tosfot says that there are some Gemaras that have Shlomo's name, which would put the end of Tehillim still in David's time, which means Al Yedei David probably means that he orchestrated, he gave people advice. He had 10 composers. And he gave them a little advice. Asaph, you work this way. Haman, you work that way. And then there's some earlier ones even before David's time. If you notice, the earlier ones are Adam HaRishon, Melchizedek, he's the guy who came out to Abraham. Abraham himself, Moshe Rabbeinu. Obviously, David couldn't have written these, so I guess there you have to say that David redacted them, edited them, reshaped and reformed. This is one rabbinic opinion. The second rabbinic opinion is in Shir HaShirim Rabbah, where there is no argument that Ezra was one of the 10 people who to write Tehillim. Ezra was not in the time of David. Ezra was 500 years after King David. He was after the Babylonian exile. This is a rabbinic opinion. And here's where you get into issues. How do I know when my psalm was written? My psalm, the psalm that we're dealing with now, is all about I wish I could get back to Zion. I wish I could get back to the temple. Your first inclination is that it must have been written then. After the exile. During the exile. Okay, probably sometime during the 70 years. And it's possible. And here's my thinking on the matter. If you think about Tehillah 137, which is famous, Al Harop Bavel, Sham Yashavnu, Gam Bachim, Zachorinu Et Zion, to say that David wrote that is very difficult. Of course, Rashi Gaon would say he wrote it in Nevuah. He saw the Jews on the rivers of Babylon crying over their lost country. That's a pretty rough Nevuah to send to David. The goal of Nevuah is to get people to change their ways so they can prevent something from happening. Nevuah is very rarely 500 years in the future. It has no goal. It has no purpose. There's nothing David could have done. So why give it to him? And that's my sense of these things. To say that David wrote all the Psalms strikes me as a little difficult, to say the least, and sometimes even unfair. And the support, of course, is this Shir HaShirim Medrash, which is written also by Tanayim, which puts Ezra as the last of the psalmists. Now, Ezra lived after the exile, not only after the exile, but 150 years after the exile. Right? Zerubbabel was the one who took us back to Israel. Ezra lived about 100 years later. He was during the second Aliyah from Persia, actually, in the time of even after the time of Kush. The question is, what about our psalm? And here's something which is important about psalms. A lot of people spend a lot of time trying to date them, but it's not important. Because the psalm's message tends to be internal and tends to be... People are always upset that Tehillim, it becomes a closed book because you can't quite tell what the Tehillah is about, right? Tachanun that we say every day. We have no idea what's going on. I mean, we have a sense. There's some difficulties. What are we talking about? What hate are we talking about? But just like a good rock and roll song, which is vague, because in that vagueness of poetry, it becomes transcendental. People are upset with psalms. You read literature where people are upset with psalms. How come he didn't tell us what was going on? Why hint? Why allude? Why? Give us the facts. And yet nobody would criticize a piece of medieval poetry, or more specifically, a piece of modern rock. Any good classic song transcends its scope. This psalm may have been written by somebody living out in Babylon, in exile. Or maybe written by somebody who's very old, who can't make the trip to Yerushalayim anymore. He's too old to get on the bus or get on the plane to fly to Israel. Or he broke his leg and he finds he can't make the walk. Or it could have been one time that Yerushalayim was under attack by the enemies and there still was a temple, but nobody could cross enemy lines. Could be all of those things, it could be any of those things, and ultimately that's the important thing to understand about psalms. They are vague on purpose, because when David wrote them, or whoever wrote them, they were meant to be transcendental. It could be this psalm was written after the exile, but it could be that it wasn't written after the exile. It could be somebody who's just lonely and sad about the things that he remembered, and this way it speaks to many, many more people, and that's an important idea as you approach any kind of Tehillah. To look at the vagueness as a gift to a certain degree. It's being written just like, I don't know, I think of a rock and roll song that's vague specifically. I don't know, nothing comes to mind that may be very, very popular. But what's that? Oh, beautiful. Yesterday, love was, that could apply to anybody at any time. Anybody who feels those emotions could then sing that song by the Beatles and feel Let It Be, all those things. Now maybe Hey Jude was talking about something in specific, but it applies to anybody who feels that kind. That's beautiful, actually. Beatles, always go back to the Beatles, I guess. It's always a good thing not to compare David and Elkin to the Beatles, but okay, they weren't bad. I mean, it wasn't like the Stones we were doing, so at least it was the Beatles. Thank you for not picking a Stones song, that's it. Okay, if you have the packet, we'll skip to to water imagery. On the top of the page where it says water imagery. Let's start to analyze the Tehillah itself, because in the poem itself is a beautiful use of language that you can't escape from. It sort of pulls you right into it. And the imagery is not just something that's plucked out of. Imagery is, well, the psalm starts with an image, although simile, so it's a watered-down image. But it hits you right away with an image. My soul thirsts for God, for you, like a deer whose water has run dry. And the imagery brings us not only into the idea of the rain that comes on Chag Sukkot, but it gives us an idea of a person who's starving or thirsty to the point of death for what he wants. And the beautiful thing is the imagery carries through all the verses. If we take a look at the verses, I'll read them in Hebrew and translate. Pasuk Gimel, Sama'a nafshi l'Elohim, my soul is thirsty for God. La'el chai, as I mentioned, El chai should remind you of Mayim Chayim, which is the flowing waters. In Pasuk Dalet, Haita li dimati lechem yomam v'layla, my tears were my bread day and night. Be'amor alai kol hayom ayei Elohecha. When they said to me, where is your God? Eila eskrav eshpacha alai nafshi, I'm crying out my soul. The water imagery is very clear. And what's interesting here is that water, what does water represent? If you look at verse number 3, what is represented by water? The image is water, but what's behind the image? Tama'a nafshi le'lohim le'el chai. It actually makes a very beautiful kind of connection that you can't miss. God is water. That's the image that's going on here. And yet the water imagery cuts both ways. Because not only is God water, unfortunately when he brings back the imagery of God as water and of the flowing water of the temple and the flowing water of God, he gets hit with the imagery of Pasuk Dalet, which is Hayita li dimati lecha. There we also have water. But the water has changed from God as water to water as tears. It's quite a beautiful transition from one to the other. And he continues, Alai tishtochach, I'm sorry, in Pasuk Dalet, the Eshbecha alai nafshi, and I pour out my soul. Also, these are images of crying. So he's caught here between using a positive water imagery and a negative water imagery, and yet, nonetheless, if we have to say, what is water? Water is God. Overall, we have a very positive imagery of what... It's a sense of thirst, and if the person could get the water, his thirst would be slaked and he'd be able to return to what he was. If you take a look, however, in the second stanza, that's not exactly what's being described here. Starting from verse 7, Elohai, alai nafshi tishtochach, my soul is bent over. Alkene es korcha me'eretz yardein, and therefore I remember you from the lands of the Jordan, which means the river, v'cher monim mehar mitzar, and I remember you from the Cher Monim, which is also a mountain which feeds the Jordan River. If you're familiar with it, I'm sorry. So Cher Monim, of course, the Cher Mon is the big mountain that's right above the Jordan River, and it feeds the Jordan River. The Jordan River does in fact have water in it, because it snows up in the Cher Mon, and it rains, essentially it melts during the summer, it melts down into the Jordan River. Tahom el tahom korei lekol tzinorecha. Let's try the English. Deep calls to deep to the sound of your water channels. All your breakers and waves washed over me. In Hebrew, that's kol mishvarecha v'galecha alai avar. Is anybody getting a sense of what the image is? Does it remind you of anything? Kol mishvarecha v'galecha alai avar. All of your waters and breakers have passed over my head, have crossed over my head. Does that remind anybody of anything? What's that? What makes you think of that? I never thought of that before. What makes you think? Oh, it's a very interesting idea. Yeah, there's something to that, actually. Is that a positive image or a negative image? That's a very interesting. It reads as a... That's very interesting. It reads as a... What's that?
It's the judgment point of coming alive.
Perhaps. This is very interesting. I never thought of it before. I was thinking on more... What's that?
Yonah.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, before we go into Yonah, these words are straight out of Yonah. out of Yonah's prayer. So we need to, it's a direct quote from Yonah, or vice versa, Yonah's quoting this Tehillim, because we really don't know when it was written exactly. It's hard to say, it's always hard to get a synchronistic view. Either we don't know who's first and who's second. We never know who's influencing who. But one person certainly had in mind the other. But what I'd like to do is just go a little bit through water imagery, just to get a view of how it's used in Tehillim. If you don't mind, I'd sort of like to spread the shear out, not only to cover Psalm 42 and 43, but also give you a view of how these images are used throughout Tehillim. So how is water used? First of all, sometimes water is literally water. Sometimes no imagery. Very often that happens in Tehillim when the psalmist wants to recall Moses' hitting of the rock, the splitting of the Red Sea, the splitting of the Jordan, then water is essentially water. Sometimes water is used also as a very simple image, which is like something pierced my soul like water. The idea of fluidity, but there's no real imagery behind the water. You're meant to view the water. The water there is either literal or it's meant to help you understand a different image. It's not being used for the image itself. There are many Tehillim, however, where water is a personification of the chaos of Bereshit. And the word Tehom should remind you of that. Tehom, which is used in our psalm, is difficult to translate. I guess the best translation, I guess, is the deep. In fact, in Greek, it is abuso, or the abyss. Tehom is translated in Greek as the abyss. It comes, actually, from ancient Sumerian. Tehom was Tihamat, if you're familiar with some of your ancient myths, what's called Emuna Elis, which is their creation myth, was the great snake and serpent, and the god Marduk came around and fought with the famous Tihamat, who was a girl, that's why you have the tough ending, and he cut her open, and from her hide he formed the heavens, and the whole thing is really an imagery of the gods battling each other, and out of that battle was created a place for man to exist. Nachum Sarna has said very well that Bereshit, one of the purposes of the first chapter of Bereshit, is to demythify. Tihamat is removed, Tehom is left by. That is Judaism, that's not even Judaism, Israelitism, or the ancient Hebrew poets, wanted to go out of their way. In fact, if we go back to Bereshit, where we have to talk about God and Moshe, the whole point of the first parak of Bereshit, which is very poetic actually, is to tell you there is no mythology. God didn't fight anybody to create something new. There was nothing before. God created the Tehom. God created the land. God created the Tananim HaGdolim, the great serpent, which are part of that whole imagery. You think that in the old country, if you go back to the old country, you'll find out that these are great mythological characters. Here, they're simply the deep, the waters of the deep. People used to think one of the names of the Akkadian god, of a Canaanite god, was Yam and Nahar. These were rivers because people were scared of the ocean. They had a sense, like Poseidon. Think of Poseidon of the Greek mythologies. These were given not just personification. What's that? Absolutely. What's that? Oh.
Yeah.
There's no. You know what's interesting? Because today in our technological times, sometimes it's hard. You know, you read about Tehillim, which talk about darkness, and we live in such an electric age that you can't even sense darkness. I mean, even if we turned out all the lights, New York would still be glowing enough to get an idea of what's going on in the street. So in our technological age, we lose a sense. When the Tehillah talks about darkness, we lose it. Also, when the Tehillah talks about the frighteningness of the waters, we also tend to lose it. You get in the boat, you're fine. You know, and I don't know, it's everything is safe. But back then, you couldn't. Maybe now with the disaster, you get some sense of what it was like. And people would pray to these gods as a way of assuaging them. That's why, that's one of the reasons, according to Rav Yaakov Medan, that's why Paro couldn't figure out his dreams, because their view of God wasn't a God that would send them a nice message to help them out. Right? Paro's dream was a message about the future to help Paro run his country. They didn't look at gods that way. Gods were these adversarial forces. And if you cooked enough for them, right, if you gave them nice meals, they would let you, they would give you a break. That was certainly one viewpoint. So this idea of Tehom, of Tiamat, was an ancient idea which came out of the primordial, I'm scared of the ocean. The Torah takes that and it changes these words into simplistic words. Sometimes, however, the ancient mythology is brought back and Tiamat comes a little bit back and the ancient serpents come back. And the reason why that happens is because they were already demythologized. Very much like if I say I've crossed a bear. That probably doesn't mean I'm on the verge of converting to Christianity. It's become a part of what we, it's become part of speech. And it evokes an important, powerful image. It could certainly could be there some that some people in Orthodoxy would feel uncomfortable about saying I have a cross to bear, where it's that guy thinks he could walk on water, right? But these are things which have already become for us anyway the myth has been taken out. Not just in the sense that the terms have become very they've become a part of our lexicon, and therefore nobody thinks about it. We're planted. I'm planted in this place. Nobody thinks that I'm actually sprouting roots into the ground. These words, these images become part of the lexicon. They're not even looked at as images anymore. So very often you have this idea of a God as force of nature. Sometimes the Torah is water. That's the first Tehillah. Like a tree planted on the rivers of water. So the water here becomes the Torah, which feeds him. I have a few more, but I don't want to. I'll just move quickly on. Generally speaking, though, waters are terribly destructive. In Tehillim Samach Tet, it says, Hoshieni Elohim, save me, God, Hibau Mayim Anafesh, because the water is up to my nafesh, by the way, here means my throat, and means I'm up to here. I've really taken quite enough. Tehillim Pechet is Savuni Kamayim Kol Ayom Kipo Layachat. The waters are raging around me. I can't control them. Tehillah 124, if you have Tehillim, it's one of the Shir Amalot, it's short, so I'd like to read you just a little bit of it. This way we can say we did not only Psalm 42 and 43, but we pretty much covered all of Tehillim. Tehillah 124, which is very beautiful, by the way. Kuf Chaf Dalet, 124. Shir HaMalot David, Lulei Adonai Shehaya Lanu Yomar Na Yisrael. If it weren't that God was with us, oh say you of Israel, Lulei Adonai Shehaya Lanu B'kum Alenu Adam. If God wasn't with us when the enemy came to us, Azai Chayim B'la'unu, we would have been swallowed alive, B'charut HaPam Banu, they got angry at us. Azai Hamayim Shtafunu, the waters would have washed us out. Nachla Avar Al Nafshenu, the rivers would have passed over our throats. Azai avara nafshenu, it would have passed over our throats, hamayim hazedomim, these destructive waters. This is generally the sense that you have with waters. That's the usual term, the sense of I can't control, I have no ability. It's what's happened here, probably. Actually, before I get there, Eben Ezra is bothered by this. Eben Ezra. Oh, and by the way, I didn't read Yonah, but I guess we should. Then Yonah prayed out unto the Lord of God out of the fish's belly, and this is why the birth imagery is very interesting. I never thought of that, but there's something to that birth imagery. And he said, I called out of mine affliction of the Lord, and he answered me, out of the belly of the netherworld cried I, and thou heardest my voice. I'm sorry, this is a very old translation. For thou didst cast me into the depth, that's to home, into the heart of the seas, the levav yamim, and the flood was round about me, all thy waves and thy billows passed over me, literally the same words that we have in our Tehillah. The sense is not good. It's not good. It's a sense of destruction, waters over my head, I'm going to die for sure, and because you saved me, that's why I'm praying now. Although he does get saved, which is interesting, which sort of makes me out of the belly of the fish, he does get saved, so I wonder if there's an issue of deliverance there out of the watery... No, please. I'm not familiar with it.
By A.B. Rottenberg, and one of the babies was born. It turns out that they were about to be born. And they're twins. And one thinks the other's going to die and be taken away. But he's just later coming out to the birth canal.
That's very beautiful.
It's beautiful. That's why I thought
I don't know the song. Do you know the song?
I've seen it, yes.
Journey's what?
Journey's one.
Oh, I'm curious to take a... take a look.
Yeah,
there surely is something to this. And maybe, you know what, I'm going to come back to that idea in a second. I want to show you why Eben Ezra has a hard time with this. He doesn't understand. He says, wait a second, look at the verse before. If we go back to our Psalm 42, and we look at the verse 8, which sounds horrible, Tehom el Tehom, abyss to the abyss, korei l'kol tzinarecha. Tzinarecha are pipes. What they're probably talking about is the water flows from one pipe to another pipe, not literally a pipe, but like a river, it creates this gigantic, rushing, noisy, almost ungodly sound, frightening sound. All of your waves have gone over me. But Ebenezer says, look at the previous pasuk and look at the next pasuk. Look at the verses. The next verse says, Yomami tzavah adonai chasdo, God commands his charity, his loving kindness. Uvalayla shiro imi, his song is with me, tfilah le'el chayai. That's a happy verse. And the previous verse is also not unhappy. I will remember you from these river places, from these places with water. So Ibn Ezra brings down another psalm, which maybe we'll get to a little bit later, but we'll definitely run over time if we do it. If you're curious, you can make a note yourself to look at Psalm 84, which is a very positive image of a person that remembers his time in the temple. It's the sense of somebody who can go back anytime he wants, and also the idea of waters are there. And he drives this image in that Psalm 84 of the guy, they remember the waters flowing down the hills of Yerushalayim, and everybody's happy, and they've been hot all summer, and now they're taking a shower and splashing like little kids. It's a beautiful imagery. And Ibn Ezra says that's what's going on here. But I'm conflicted, because the natural language, if we compare it to, the idea of Tehom and the idea of Yonah is a very negative idea. And I think that's perhaps what's going on here. Maybe this kind of, I want to say, maybe there is something for the birth canal idea. I'm sliding down in my memories to my goal, but I have no idea whether I'm going to slip and fall and be drowned, or whether I'm going to be able to bathe and get to the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, to get to the port where we're drinking water. And I just want to, I'll take a question in a second, Debbie. I apologize. I just want to remind you that if you live in Israel, you know how rough it is, actually, right over Sukkot. You always hear stories. For people in Sukkot, it rains horribly starting Sukkot, and you always hear about these flash floods. If you're familiar, there's always some Rahman al-Mitzvah, but it always, almost always every year, first of all, the roads tend to get incredibly oily because the cars have been driving all the summer. And when the water hits, so it really slicks out and you get car accidents. But you also hear a story about a guy driving up in Sfat and the water came rushing down the mountain. And the truth is, look at California, just was it today? You know, you get, who would think of, I remember when I was living with, when Leigh and I were living in California, so there was this town that was right under a mountain, and it rained and rained on this mountain, and the whole mountain collapsed on this entire...
that's what happened today.
That's what happened today also. So there's this, what happens is, what's that?
Oh yeah,
in California. And this happened since we were there like 7-8 years ago.
Yeah.
What's that? I guess, and everything was very shaky. And now, what happens is the psalmist has sort of dug himself a watery hole. The water imagery was beautiful. He thought about how God sustains him and gives his life, and yet he can't think about the fact that God sustains his life with water, without also thinking about how water giveth and water taketh away, how the water could come down the mountain and give you something to drink, and the water could wash you away and give you nothing left to think about. Which means that the water itself, if you want, by the way, you don't have to worry about it so much. I'm also making a recording if it comes out well. Oh, okay. Do you want me to turn it? Here, I'll turn it over and... The psalmist has sort of dug himself a little bit of a hole. He's brought images which, even in the first psalm, when things were pretty happy, Hamon Chogeg, everybody was partying, he still remembered his tears. And in the second psalm, he could barely hold on to the beautiful imagery. He remembers, I can't get there, and then as he sees the water sliding down, the waters of the abyss, the waters of breakers breaking over his head, the sound of the ancient monsters, they come back to him, and he loses his sense of joy in the first stanza that he has, which is essentially a sad joy. It's a bittersweet memory with emphasis on the sweet, to where in the second stanza, I would say it's sweet bitter. It's, or worse, it's powerfully destructive. The more he tries to grab onto it, the more it slips through his fingers, which ultimately is the imagery of water. And if you take a look in your packet, if you skip over to memories like water, and I'm sorry to bounce around between the packet and the psalm, but the idea of memories is very important in our Psalm 42. So if you take a look at memories like water and also the psalm. If you look at Psalm 42, his memories of his time in the Beit HaMikdash are in verse 5, Eila es kirav es b'cha alai nafshi, this I will remember. And in stanza 2, he repeats it again in verse 7, Elohai alai nafshi tishtochacha kenes korcha me'eretz Yordain. I remember you from the Jordan areas, which means he's by the water. And when he's really sad and he's complaining, and when he gets lost in the nastiness of what his reality is, in verse 10 he says, Omrala el Sal'i, I say to the God who is my rock, Lama shechachtani, why have you forgotten me? That is, I've been focusing on remembering you, and yet you've forgotten me. Now shechachtani is a strange language. The more common language is what shows up on the next page, in verse 2 of 43. Lama zinachtani, why have you cast me aside? I think the word shechachtani is used here. Now if you notice, those two verses are almost identical. Almost identical. Why does one have shechachtani and one have zinachtani? Trying to get the sense that the more I try to remember, the more I seem to forget. And if we read, I'd like to read you this quote on Memories Like Water from the Packet, or from Eo, from the book of Job. And Eo is upset with his friends for being such lousy friends, to say the least. And he says, Achai Bagdu Kamo Nachal, you have deceived me, turned against me, like a river. Ka'afit nichalim ya'avoru. You're like the, here's the word ba'afikim, like we had in our song, you're like the rapids of the river that quickly disappear. Ha'kodrim mini karach. They get dark, the word koder, they get dark from ice, that is, they're covered by ice. Alemo yit'alim shalek. They disappear because of the snow. Be'it yizorvun in smatu. As fast as they start to flow, they dry up. I'm not going to rely on the English translation, but if you like English, it's perfectly fine. The chumal need to akum in koman. As soon as it gets hot, the rivers are gone. Yilaftu orchot.com. They change their riverbeds. I looked for them in one place, and now they're running some other place. Yalu batohu vayovedu. And then they go up the tohu, which is similar to the word to home. They disappear. Hibitu orchot tema. The people from tema, they come looking for water, these travelers of the desert. Halichot shva, the people from Sheba, they look for these waters. Boshu, Kibatach, and they're embarrassed because they had faith that they'd find these waters. Ba'u adecha v'yechparu, they come to where they thought the waters were and they start digging because there is no water. Kiatahi yitam lo, you're like nothing to me. Teruchatach, you see my pain, you see my fear. Batirau, and you're afraid of everything. He's talking to his friends. The image here is of like a water slips through your fingers. The more the basis of the memories and the basis of the water are the same. The more you try to grab onto them, the more you realize that they're not real. And you live in the sense, what he's saying is, I'm living in the sense of I sit around and all I do is put on the videotape and remember the old days when my kids used to play in the waters. But the more you watch it, the more it makes you sad for the things that you no longer have. And the more you think about the waters, the more you realize that those memories are like the river. They come and they go. They're untrustworthy and they disappear. And you see that from stanza 1, where God was water, to stanza 2, where water is at the worst destruction and at best a 50-50. And that's the flow. So what is the psalmist to do? What does the psalmist learn from himself? Fortunately, we have stanza 3. So let's take a look at stanza 3. Before we do, remember that word koder. The word koder meaning darkness. Actually, before we get to stanza 2 and 3, sorry, stanza 2, let's take a look at the thing that connects stanza 2 and 3, which is verse 10 again. Omrala el Sali, verse 10 on the first one. Lama shechachtani, lama koder eleich v'lachat oyev. Why do I walk in darkness from the pressure of my enemies? There's that word koder. Now remember, in Eov, the word koder described darkness, but specifically the darkness of a river as it disappears. So you're connecting the water imagery with the darkness imagery. Now, if we turn the page to 43, he repeats the same psukim. Ki atalo heima ozi lama znaftani, lama koder et halech v'lachat oyev. Now, the question is, what's the difference between elech and et halech? Because that's a significant change. He quotes the verse almost exactly. He changes shechachtani to zinachtani, but he changes elech et halech. And the question is, why make such a small and significant change? So if you know anybody know their hitzpah el form? No, it's not exactly passive. Walk myself, that's correct. The main purpose of Hitzpael is it's self-referential. It's reflexive. In fancy grammar terms, it's reflexive. Why am I doing it to myself? Hitzkaleach means to shower. Means I'm showering myself. Hitzlabesh means I am dressing myself. And et halech doesn't mean I will walk, but it means I'm walking myself, which means What am I doing to myself? I'm driving myself crazy. And now look at the turnaround in verse 3. Shlach orcha v'amitcha hema yanchuni. Remember, the river is dried up and he walks in darkness. What's the solution for that? In verse 3, what's the image that comes out powerfully in verse 3 to counter that darkness? The light. Do you see that? And he's not remembering anything more. The first two stanzas were all about, oh, it used to be this way, and I remember it was like this, and I'll remember you, and you'll remember me, and I'll remember this. That's not what happens in verse 3. Shlach orcha v'amitcha hema yanchuni. Shlach is a command to God. Send me your light, and they will give me rest. And when you send me to that light, that light will cause me to come, will bring me to your Beit HaMikdash. I'm not in the past anymore. The first two stanzas are in the past. The third stanza is in the future. This is what I want. This is what I hope for. This is what I'm going to do. Va'avoa, let me come. Now, he's not completely free. He's in a situation, whatever our psalmist is in, whether he's got a broken leg or he's sick or he's old or he's in exile, he can't make it all by himself. That he admits. But he's no longer going to say, all I have is memories. If you give me a little push, if you show me the light, to use a cliche, but the cliche probably came from here when it wasn't a cliche, if you show me the light, then I will be able to come. Let me come and I'll come. And now it's not let me, but it's I will. And I will take up my harp. Elohim Elohai, oh my God. And that's a tremendous change. It's from the water imagery and the dream imagery that I couldn't get my handle on, that was just a wish for the past, to the light imagery from darkness. The water left them in the darkness. They said, I have a solution. It's the light. And if you send me the light, I will make it happen. Or if you get me there, I'll finish the job. And that's a beautiful transition from 42, which is down and struggling, from first hopes to death, until where the point where the guy says, hey, I've got to grab myself by the shoulders and make it happen. Right, it's getting pretty late. I just want to end off with the refrain, which is, Ma tishtochachi nafshi u'mata emi alai, hochil le'elohim kiyodo deni shor panai ve'elohai. It's an important verse, and I was going to read a few other Tehillim, but really if we did it would take too long. So I'll just tell you, and it's worth, if you get a chance, look at Tehillah 131 and 39. These are Tehillim about where a person conflicts with himself. There is in Tehillim an idea where if you see the word alai and nafshi together, there's this conflict between the ego and the me, between the, it's hard to say, between the psychological me and the emotional me, between the spiritual me and the practical me. You have this conflict in Tehillim all the time. What am I doing to myself? In 131, a beautiful tefillah, is one of the last Shir HaMaalot, he essentially says, I didn't step beyond myself. I took myself and it rested on my soul like a baby in his mother's arms, which means I was comfortable with myself. I was okay. I was neither too great for myself nor too little for myself. I knew how to take care of myself. It's a three psukim, by the way, and that's really the flow of the verses. In verse 39, it's kind of a bummer. It's a guy who says, I promise, he's suffering, and he wants to yell at God. He says, I'm not going to say anything, but I'll tell you what I'm going to say. There's this four verses where I can't hold it back, and boom, it bursts out, and it's a horrible, the Tehillah 39, some people won't say it. There's the famous Eben Ezra, where he talks about a Chacham from Sfarad that simply won't say. There are two or three Tehillim that he just won't say because they're so rough. Tehillim 39 is a very rough Tehillah, but it's an important, it's very much like Sefer Eo. It's very rough Tehillah. But the conflict that you see between, oh, I can handle, I can be good, and then he fails is important. Ma tishtochachi nafshi, the best way to translate it, is why is my soul bending down? Why am I lowering myself? Uma tehemi alai, and why is it freaking out on me? That's what tehemi, lehamon, means. The hemi is hemayun, is like in a state of shock. Sorry, excuse me. We said that that's on the Shir Mizmor for today, by the way. At the end of davening, we say, Hema rao kein nivalu, nechvazu nivalu. I lost it, but I think it's there. Mm-hmm. This idea of shock, that is, what's going on in the stanza, and the reason why, in the refrains, and the reason why it's going forth is the refrains, and this is also, I'd love to teach it to you, because they're about eight or nine tehillim with refrains. And the refrains, it's always whenever you have a tehillah with refrains, first of all, it breaks it up really nicely, so it's nice to handle. But also, it really gives you a sense of what the tehillah is all about. Sometimes it's a counterintuitive, that it stands against the tehillah. Sometimes it, very often it gives you a sense of what's going on. This guy is calling out to himself. He's not calling out to God at all. This is not a prayer to God. What are you doing, myself? You see, he's talking to himself. Why are you freaking out on me? He's yelling at his nefesh for doing his alai himself wrong. Go pray to God. He owed Odenu, because I will not stop giving him praise. Yeshuot Panai Velohai. He is the salvation. His face, it's a very difficult passage, but let's say his face is my salvation. And this refrain goes over and over, and the reason why it goes over and over is a hint at what's to come. Because the truth is, in the first stanza, he's thinking about God as beautiful. He says, there's nothing to worry about. God is like a water of life. And then it hits him that God is, could also be water of death. And every time he tries to get through Shemayim, he can't make it for whatever horrible reason. He says, my soul is now angry at me. What is it doing? And then he turns around and he says, I know what to do. Stop the internal conflict. Stop, oh, I remember how it used to be, and if only it were like that, and wasn't life so good in the past? Life is good now. Cut it out. Look what you're doing to yourself. Keep praying to God. Don't stop. Start. And then the salvation of his faith will become immediately abundant. And that's really the goal of Psalm 42 and 43. It's a restorative. It talks about the desire to come to Yerushalayim. And most importantly, it talks about a person who's coming out of self-pity and self-sorrow, who realizes the best way to save yourself is to save yourself. That's really the Psalm. I'm sorry, I kind of run over questions. I apologize. Actually, it's a great question. It's one of the things I forgot, and it's important to do. If you take a look at the verse, the most common word in the verse, if you take a look at verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, the whole kit and caboodle. I have a recording, by the way, which I'll have on the internet, so if you want, you can grab it off the internet. If it works, if my recorder works correctly. It looks like it's worked correctly. If you take a look, the most common word in almost every verse shares this word. Somebody take a look and see what word jumps out at you. Every single verse, almost except for 2, has this word at least once. Nafshi is common, it's true, but there's more common ones. Yeah, Elohim. Every single one. Elohim, verse 1. Verse 2. Elohim, El Chai, don't forget the word El, and then Elohim, 3 times. In verse number 4, we have Ayei Elohecha. In verse verse 5, we have, it's not there, is it? we have Beit Elohim. Good. Verse 6, we have Elohim. Verse number 7, we have Elohai. Verse number 8 is missing. Verse number 9, we have Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei, which means he's probably, and then it has El Chai at the end. The reason why it has Yud Kei Vav Kei is he's probably talking about an earlier song. He's talking about a song, so that song probably had Yud Kei Vav Kei in it rather than Elohim. Almost every verse is Elohim, Elohim. The question is why? I mean, obviously, if he's doing that, and it goes all the way through. You can look all the way through. It must appear, I don't know, it's got to appear 30, 40 times in this verse. And in one of the last verses, it says like this. Va'avoa, in verse number 4, 43, it says, Va'avoa mizbach Elohim, I will come to, here you can't miss it because you're beaten over the head with the word Elohim. Va'avoa el mizbach Elohim el simchat gili, I will come to the altar of my God, to the God who is the God of my happiness. Va'odcha b'chinor, and I will praise you with my heart. Elohim Elohai. Elohim Elohai. It's kind of weird, isn't it? My God, God, my God. I mean, I don't understand. That's to counter the enemies here. Two places, only two places the enemies show up. And let's see what the enemies say. In verse number 4, Haitali dimati lechem yomam v'layla b'moravai kol hayom ayei elohecha. So they used to stand around and say, where's your God? And that doesn't mean where's your God. What it really means is, you have no God. Either because he's abandoned you, which people say to us today, by the way. Just be aware of the fact that people say that to us today, that we were the chosen people and then we were unchosen and your God is no longer your God. It's an important idea to understand the Tefillah is not really anachronism to a certain extent. I'm not trying to build up any anger against anybody, Chas v'Shalom, but and I'm not talking about any specific individual, but as a philosophy, this is still a problem. And in verse 4 of the next one, in the second stanza, the Retzach be'atzmotai, like murder in my bones, or murder myself. Cherfuni tzarai, they make fun of me, they shame me. But umram elai kol hayom ayei elohecha. They don't do anything else. They don't hit me, they don't slap me, they don't throw rocks at me, nothing. All they say is, where's your God? Which means you have no God. That's countered by Elohim Elohecha. What was your question again?
Who the ayeh?
Oh. It does talk about, that's correct, there is an external oyev here, but he's very, very light. That is, he's not, there's not a major play here, and yet in some psalms, there's a major play. When we say Tehillim in the morning, it's all about us and our pain and God, and all of a sudden at the very end it says, Kishama Adonai kol b'chi, Shema Adonai tzirati Adonai tzirati ikach, let all my enemies dry up and wither away. It seems so out of place. I was talking about them. I was talking about God, my pain, the whole thing. What do I need to beat up on my enemies for? I don't understand. Not only that, Tehillah 137, Al Maharof Bazel. It's a beautiful thing. And there are enemies there. Enemies are saying, hey, why don't you sing a song from Zion? We say, how can we sing songs from Zion? Of course, right after they say, well, how can we sing songs from Zion? Then they go on to sing a song about Zion, which is a separate issue. And then they talk about some enemies. And what's the last line in 137? We don't even sing it. I remember when Leah taught me the song, Chabad, before benching, always sings 137. But they never sing the last line. No way. Anybody happen to know what the last line is? I'll read it to you. It's a shocker. Yeah. That's right. That's right. 137 ends off with... Let me. I want to make sure I get the words right, because it has been misquoted to a great deal of anti-Jewish feeling. 137 reads, Bat Bavel Ashtuda, Fair Babylon, you predator. Ashrei sheyisham lem lach et molech shemat lanu. Let a blessing on him who repays you in kind what you have inflicted on us. Ashrei sheyochez v'ni peitzito layach al asala. A blessing on him who seizes your babies and dashes them against the rocks. It seems so out of place. Especially in the 21st century, it seems barbaric. I have two answers, a bad answer and a good answer. A bad answer is, if we had lived 50, 60 years ago, we might have felt very differently about it. Bavel were a bunch of guys who asked us to live in some other country, please. they killed most of the Jews, or exiled most of the Jews in Israel. There was not a sense of, I could take an easy or be humanistic, or it was a battle to the death. And this singer is singing about a battle to the death against people that will soon as kill you as looking. But you know what, I still don't like that, because I don't think first of all, it strikes it too much in the revenge orientation, but also it's actually not correct. And I actually brought a book. Can you pass me that second book? Thank you. C.S. Lewis is a great philosopher, a great Christian philosopher. He wrote The Language and the Wardrobe. You're probably familiar with that, which I remember I read as a little kid, and when I was like 7 or 8, and I loved it. And then when I read it as 12, I was really angry because I was like, oh no, Aslan is Jesus. And I was really upset that I was tricked as a kid, and then I got over it, and I realized it's a nice philosophy. Screwtape Letters is a wonderful book of Musar, and while there is a little bit of Christological issues, it's mostly about how people deal with each other, and it's a wonderful book of Musar, and I would suggest it to anybody to read. This book is reprehensible, and it's understandably reprehensible. He has this whole chapter, including on 137, he says, listen, he says, to us, very often, to us Christians, most Psalms are a closed book because of the Jews and the desire for revenge. And even though our God wants us to forgive and forget, to turn the other cheek, you have to understand this is the way they feel, and that's what they want to say, so just try to ignore it. It's not so bad. You know, Jews are mostly excited, except for that little problem where they like to kill people and they get on their bad side. It's not quite as bad, and C.S. Lewis is not an anti-Semite, in no way. But there's this sense that that's what the Tehillah is about, that I need to take part of my happiness, take revenge on the enemies. And unfortunately, and he admits at the beginning, he's not a Psalm scholar, and he's really not a Psalm scholar, because if he was a Psalm scholar, he would have read the Tehillah that we read every day on Wednesday. That's a really long one. And I'd like to read you a verse from it, which will explain everything about it. It has this long bit about how the enemy should get theirs. And it says this very important line, which is a key to all revenge against the enemy verses. And I'm not making this up. This is not apologetics. This is, in my opinion, the correct and true understanding of everything where you say the enemy should get theirs. Lama yomru ha-goyim, ayei Eloheihem. If we suffer, which is what is being described, you make us suffer and they get good stuff. Next, 2 days from now, if you take a look at the Tehillim, that's what it's all about. They get all kinds of nice things and we suffer. What's the problem with that? Lama yomru ha-goyim, ayei Eloheihem. Why do the enemy say, where is your God, which means you have no God? That is, the problem with the enemies not getting theirs is that the enemies have committed sins. And if you sin and nothing happens to you, then it rips at the very fabric of belief in God. What are you supposed to say to somebody? It's the essence of theodicy, of justifying God. I'm a good person, and bad things happen. And this guy is a rotten schlub, and he lives a happy life. And if that happens, then people don't believe God. God, you want people to believe in you? You want us to be able to convince people to believe in you? So when a person does something bad, they should be punished. And when a person does something right, they should be rewarded. And if my enemies, who I've done nothing against, are destroying me and destroying you and destroying your country, and they're not destroyed themselves, and people say, Ayei Eloheihem, Yivada b'goyim le'inedu, the nations need to know, and we need to see them know, Nikmat dam avadecha shafuch, they need to see that the blood of your people that they've spilled, vengeance is taken against them. And this pasuk states exactly why. Not because we need vengeance, not because we get a thrill out of watching our enemies die, which is of course the famous thing about why we spill the blood, why we spill the wine at the Seder. Because God says to his angels, how dare you sing a song while my people are dying? The goal is not revenge. And I have to tell you, I would suggest not reading this book unless you're really good at Psalms, because he mistranslates psukim to get his point across, which is very surprising for C.S. Lewis. It's a misinterpretation. Every time in the psalm where it says our enemies need to get theirs, because if they don't, the very fabric of Judaism is left in doubt. And the reason why there's this conflict against the enemies is this guy's sitting, he can't get home. And the other people who are living there going, huh, you know why you're in exile? Because God doesn't want you anymore. Or better yet, there is no God. And that's why he's saying, Elohim Elohai, the first thing I'll say is, you're my God, because the first thing I need to do is establish that you're fair. Once I establish that you're fair, then everything else happens along. And I think that's why there's this conflict against enemies. And it's an important idea when you read Tehillim to understand that. And Chas v'Shalom, I mean, not many of us get into conversations with Christian theologians, but it's something that you do here. You know, the Jews are bloodthirsty people. It's nonsense. The Jews need to know that God takes care of good people and God punishes bad people, even though you look around the world, and sometimes it's very difficult, sometimes it's very, very difficult to see. That's the idea there in the song. So thank you. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have left out.
I'm sure you're doing kind of
Well, I don't actually come into contact. I simply read you know, New Testament and other literatures. There's a sense that there's an abrogation of the treaty. The treaty was abrogated. The exile took place because the treaty was abrogated, and that's it. Nothing left. And we firmly believe that the treaty was never abrogated and never will be. So that's our sense. But that's really a topic of and by the way, Hashem, I'm in no way. In no way am I an expert on comparative religions. There are experts around, but I am in no way an expert on comparative religions. I certainly don't mean to say anything bad against any Christian at all. But
we need to be vigilant, and we need to be appropriate if we think that they're believing in certain things.
Our sense, the fact that it's called the Old Testament and the New Testament is something that we should never buy into. We should never call the Old Testament, the New Testament, the New Testament, because the Christians feel that means the Old was old and it was new. And the nice thing is they got all of the laws, the 613 laws, those are not necessary anymore, which is convenient, right? Not only do I get a new covenant, but I don't have to keep all the laws of the old one. That's something I have to say, I read, you know, New Testament literature, you're sort of stuck with it because that's what it's called. But generally speaking, perhaps the Jewish Testament and the Christian Testament is a better way to say things. We simply never feel that God would never abrogate his covenant. We have psukim that tell us that. I will keep my covenant with you forever and ever. And there's nothing ever that could undo that. Exile is, in fact, a part of Bereshit. Bereshit starts with an exile from Gan Eden. And then it has an exile of Abraham going to Egypt. And then it has Yaakov going to Lavan. It's Yosef going back to Egypt. It's all about exile and redemption. So the idea that exile spells redemption goes against the entire book of Genesis, which is that when you do bad, you are exiled. And then when you pray to God again, he brings you back home. So really, the idea that exile is a one-way door, I think, argues against the entire fabric of our testament.
Mm-hmm.
My
thing. Just one quick comment, though, because you said before that that the Shemim of Kippurim are days because it makes them transcend the time or place. And I think one of the things that's striking, again, especially in terms of Christian beliefs, or just in terms of practice, is I noticed, you know, after 9/11, for instance, any service you watched on television were people reading Tehillim. The Christian approach is to see sacred Tehillim as something they relate to. And they'll pick different ones. To me, it was unusual. Like, they'll pick something, and I'm like, I never heard that one. But they don't say that. And it's like, just in terms of the ideas of personal suffering and comfort and where you find it, they say what we say. It's the same language, it's the same verses. And so it's sad when there are things that are misinterpreted or used, you know, when they're taken out of context, then they have to make a different point. But sometimes it's the same language. It's like, why can't we see that we're saying the same thing? And, you know, and because the Shorish
and I didn't mean to make it. The truth is that I may have, because I left it for last, I may have overemphasized my some of my anti-Christological point. As you're saying, Psalm 23, though that I walk through the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. So that's probably the most common poem.
Yeah, that's
right.
For every auditorium. They always said that's exactly what I was.
I used to read it all the time.
Well, you know,
even in high school,
I went to a grammar school in Newark that was like 98% Jewish. Okay,
huh?
We had a complete Christmas program. When the principal was Jewish, the choir director was Jewish. The kids singing the Christmas carols, the audience was Jewish. I was just like, yeah, everybody, you know, everybody was Jewish, and we had the whole thing was soup to nuts. A complete Christian thing, but, you know, hey.
Well,
some,
it really
the
is.
It
is traumatic. And I think that in many churches, they won't sing a good 30 or 40 psalms because they consider them a little too Jewish, too angry. But there are many psalms which transcend that.
Those were angry psalms.
Yeah, they're not turn the other cheek psalms.
Mm.
You know, that's true. I mean, that in that sense, C.S. Lewis is right. We have never been a turn the cheek people, and we don't plan on being turn the cheek people. It's not part of our makeup for reasons which I think at least one reason which I mentioned, but it could be other reasons as well. Because justice is justice and needs to be done. But there are many some which are, and I tend to be rather optimistic of. To say that the Jews have failed to be a light unto nations, I'm not sure is true at all. The fact that so many people believe in God and so many people say the same words that we do, I think speaks to the success of David HaMelech and all the people that David trained until the book was completed. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. It is transcendent and transcends religions as well. And that's probably what Yeshayahu said. In those days, when those days will come, all the nations will come up to my house. And my house will be a house of prayer for all the nations. It never says that he's converting to Judaism. It just has to come up to the house and pray. And I think that is a positive message. So. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming.
Yeah.
I want to ask you something. You build out something which is very interesting. And that is, you know, God, I'm not sure.